All right, let's get started. Hello, everybody. My name is Davide. I'm a production engineer at Facebook, and I'll be talking about what we've been doing with systemd for the past year. So before we begin, here's the agenda for today. I'll start with a quick recap of the story so far. We'll talk about how we are keeping systemd updated in our fleet and how we are tracking upstream changes. We'll focus on a couple of things we've been working on lately around resource management and service monitoring. Then we'll discuss a few case studies that hopefully showcase a bunch of interesting problems we've seen, and close with a couple of words about advocacy. So I was at systemdconf about a year ago, and at the time we were moving the fleet from CentOS 6 to CentOS 7. My team works on the, I'm on the operating system team. My team is responsible for the bare metal experience of the fleet. So we maintain what keeps the physical machines at Facebook running. We maintain the operating system, which is CentOS. We take care of packaging. We take care of configuration management using Chef, among other things. Our fleet is made of hundreds of thousands of physical machines spread around various data centers in the world. And all these machines run CentOS. And that's what runs the website and everything else. So about a year ago, we were moving from 6 to 7. And on 6, we had like 5 or 6 different crazy ways of supervising services. On 7, we have systemd. And I'm happy to say that now we are everywhere we're running CentOS 7 and everywhere we're running systemd, which makes me personally very happy because we managed to get rid of all of these crazy ways of doing service supervision. And as part of this, we got to migrate a lot of services to systemd, and we got to see a lot of people that started building their services with systemd in mind and started leveraging more and more features. And one thing we also did to help this, we started integrating libsystemd in our internal build system so that people are now able to use features like socket activation and all these features directly in our daemons that make people's life a bit easier. This talk will focus primarily on the bare metal. Zil and Zoltan are going to give a talk later today about containers. So if you're interested about systemd in containers, I recommend you attend the later talk. So let's talk a bit about how we are managing systemd on the fleet. So in general at Facebook, we manage machines using Chef. And we have a system to do package updates on machines in a controlled fashion. So we can say, this package is pinned to this version, and then 1% of the fleet gets this other version, then 2%, 5%, and so on and so forth. And that's the system we use for managing updates of system packages. So about a year ago, we were on systemd 2.31, and we went from 31, 32, 32, 33, 33, 34. Right now, we have about half the fleet on 2.33 and the other half on 2.34, and I'll explain why in a few slides. We also started testing 2.35. We run CentOS 7 because we want a stable base and we want to be able to pull security updates in an automated fashion. But we also want to have a modern user space. So we backport a lot of core system components from Fedora Rawhide. So these components are systemd, of course, but it's also a lot of the ancillary ecosystem. So we backport things like Dbus and Util Linux and ProcPS and a lot of these basic system tools. So the experience you get using the system is somewhat similar to the experience you would have using a Fedora system, at least from the point of view of a developer. We publish these backports on GitHub, and you can get them on that GitHub org. These are just the spec files and whatever patches we have. Systemd there is on 2.35. This is actually something that came out from last year's conference, because people were actually interested in this, so we made an effort to get them published. And then Jan on Reddit was kind enough to make a copper from these packages. So if you happen to run CentOS 7 and happen to want a modern systemd, you can get binary packages directly from there. And those are also mostly up to date. And if you need earlier versions, you can go back in the GitHub history. Now, of course, having a lot of machines, the updates aren't always smooth and things can happen. And I'm going to go over a few interesting things that happen during package updates that might make things a little bit more interesting. So the first thing is not actually a systemd-specific thing. It's just something that happens in general when you are dealing with a large fleet of Red Hat systems and have to update packages on all of them. And it's like issues generally around RPM. So machines can get in bad states for various reasons. You can have issues around power loss. You can have people running kill-9 on things or processes running kill-9 on things that can leave the system in weird and interesting states. And this can result in fun situations. So some things we found, and we always get these, every time we update a major package on the fleet, we always get a sizable number of these things. And we get issues like duplicated packages. So you end up with a machine that has both systemd 2.33 and systemd 2.34 installed at the same time, which is not ideal. And you fix this using something called package cleanup, which is a tool part of YAMUtils. But of course, you don't want to do this by hand. So what we do is that we have a small shell script that runs at the beginning of every time we run Chef on the machine. Chef runs every 15 minutes to convert the machine to the steady state. Before Chef runs, we want to make sure the machine is not terribly messed up. So we run this package cleanup wrapper that just runs package cleanup in various ways and tries to resolve the transactions back and forth. And that's one thing. The other issue you can have is general issues around RPMDB corruption. And this happens especially if you happen to like kill RPM in the middle of a transaction, there's a very good chance you'll end up with a database in bad state. And there's not really a single recipe to fix this. Like a lot of time, you have to try various solutions. So we wrote a tool called DCRPM that takes care of these and tries a few remediations back and forth and wiggles the database until the machine is in a like non-terrible state. The package cleanup stuff is not terribly interesting because it's just a shell script. DCRPM is actually somewhat interesting, and we're looking at trying to get it open sourced. We just finished it, rewriting it in a way that should be more maintainable. So with these two together, you tend to get a system in a reasonable state unless it's like really broken because of, say, hardware issues. But then you can end up with other interesting problems. Like we've seen when we did the, I think it was 231 to 232, we saw that we had a lot of machines that would come up, they would do the upgrade, and then suddenly basically nothing would really work. Like you run systemctl and it would fail, and the machine would be really sad. And it turns out for reasons unclear to this day, we ended up with PD1 running 234, but the libraries systemdlibs from 233. And they're dynamically linked, and nothing really works at that point. So my fix for this, which I'm not proud of, but works, is in the sequence of remediation, running LDD on the binary for PD1, grepping for stuff missing, and forcing a reinstall of all the packages to the right version. Surprisingly, this works. It's a fairly crude solution, and like it's not great, but these together puts us in a state where we can update systemd and other major packages, and like we do similar things for other packages. And the first two are generic. The last thing is specific to systemd, but these together puts us in a state where we are okay. We can update systemd and other packages on the fleet in a reasonable fashion. Then there's the other side of the coin, where like we have to track what's going on in upstream. And upstream makes changes. And one change that happened a few releases ago was the change of the build system from AutoTools to Mason. And if you're not familiar with this, Mason is this new Python-based build system, and upstream systemd transitioned from one to the other. And they had both supported in one version, and then they dropped AutoTools. And that's fine, okay. We expected to have to do a bunch of work. Luckily, the Fedora packagers already did all the work, because the Fedora packaging was moved to Mason almost immediately. So we had time to basically rebuild our backport on top of the new packaging, and it was mostly okay. The annoying bit there was that Mason on CentOS didn't actually work at all. So we had to backport Mason and Ninja and a few other ancillary Python things to keep it happy and fed. But that worked well. One good thing, though, we got out of this was some improvements on the compatlibs. So compatlibs is something that's really old and cranky about that, unfortunately, we have to deal with. So CentOS 7 ships with systemd 2.19, I believe, like a fairly old version of systemd. And that version was before there was the library split. So older version of systemd shipped with split libraries. So you have libsystemd daemon, libsystemd login, libsystemd whatever. Newer version shipped with just libsystemd, and all the symbols are there. It happens that packages like, say, Apache or Samba or like a lot of system packages you really don't want to rebuild link to the old libraries. So if you want to use the new systemd, you need the old libraries in one way or another. And upstream drop support for these because they're ancient. So we used to have these pretty nasty patches to reinstate them and plumb them in the build system. And that worked. It was quite a pain to keep it forwarded, but it was fine. With the move to Mason, that patch had to be tossed because it wasn't really workable. So we started approaching alternative solutions. And the thing we came out with was stealing some of the code from that patch, making it into a standalone project, and leveraging the subprojects feature in Mason. So now we have a standalone thing that when it builds, it picks up a copy of the latest systemd, builds the compat libraries and links it to the domestic symbol, and gives you these .SOs, and these work. So we published this, and it's available on GitHub on that org in case you, you need it. We also publish the RPMs that we use in the other repo, in the RPM backports, so you can also directly get spec files. We're going to keep these mostly up to date and in sync with systemd, even if you don't really need to, because these symbols are so old that they're not really expected to change. Okay, then there's interesting things that happen because we have a special environment. So when we rolled, I said before, we are on 2.3.3 half and 2.3.4 half. The reason is because we were doing 2.3.4 and it was fine. We would lose a few machines, but you always lose a few machines. That's okay. And then we bumped the shard to do the update to go to like 50%. And we lost a lot of machines, and that's not great. And we started looking at what was happening. And you go on these machines, and SSH takes 5 minutes to let you in. You get on the machine, and systemd just hangs. Like, you do systemctl, and it stops. And these things are not good. You run trace against PID1, and you see it's hanging, trying to open a TTY, trying to open TTY0, which is really not good. And we pinned this down that it ran daemon the re-exec. It went from 2.3.3 and 2.3.4, and 2.3.4 got stuck trying to open this TTY. After some digging, it turns out our container manager, Tupperware, also happens to fiddle with the TTY. And the code in the kernel that deals with this is pretty old. And there's probably a race there. And we don't know yet what this is. We're still trying to figure it out. But the current theory is that there's a user-friendly bug in the line discipline code on your TTY subsystem that is triggered sometimes if you call daemon re-exec on a machine that's also running our container manager that happens to do things to TTY0. In some cases, we have an artificial repo of this, but the actual repo is pretty hard to get. So the fix is that Tupperware probably should not fiddle with TTYs at all. That's like old code we should not have. So we can fix that if we just make it use a PTY. But there's also a bug in the kernel that our kernel folks are trying to figure out. And that's an example of something that you're unlikely to get if you have a few machines or even a lot of machines. But when you have hundreds of thousands of machines, these kind of crazy things unfortunately come up. All right, now let's talk about interesting things we're doing with systemd. And the first thing is resource management. So we're interested in resource management because we run a lot of things on our machines, and we want to be able to control and make sure the machine, as the machine is doing what it's supposed to do, and the process that it's supposed to run that does actual work, say the web server, has the resources it needs and doesn't get contention from like random ancillary services, say the thing that controls power on the machine. So we do this using cgroup2. And I'm not going to talk about cgroup2 because my coworker Chris is going to do a talk on this tomorrow. So if you're interested in cgroup2, you should attend that. For the purpose of this, cgroup2 is a kernel API that lets you set resource limits on processes. And by resource limits, I mean things like memory, CPU, and I/O. And systemd leverages this, and systemd lets you apply limits to your processes and to your services. And it also lets you bucket your services and partition them in slices and apply limits to the slices as a whole. So we use this, and we use this to bucket the services and apply these limits. That's part of the picture. That's the implementation. You also need a way to tell, though, what's going on. And we do that with a small daemon that runs on the boxes that picks metrics from SysFS cgroup and shoves them in our monitoring. So we can get data around, OK, the limit is set here, and the current memory usage is there. This is actually working, or, oh, this is thrashing. There's a problem here. The other thing we do is that we have an API in Chef that lets people define and set these changes without having to go on individual host and like do systemctl edit and change things. And the way we do this is that we have an API in Chef, and this translates to override systemd override files. So it applies the changes, and you can say, change the memory limit for this thing here, or move this service from this bucket to this other bucket. And this is something that's very much in progress, and we're still learning what the right things to do are. This is the general hierarchy we're using right now, where there's a system bucket, and that's stuff that runs on the box that needs to run on the box, but is not critical to what the box is supposed to do. There's workload, which is what the box is supposed to do, say MySQL or HHVM, the web server, or whatever. And then we have another bucket that's called TBD, inventively, that's meant for stuff that we need to run unrestricted. Say the hardware folks have to do a stress test on the box, and that doesn't need to be limited because it's a stress test. So the initial idea was, okay, we'll like cap system to 4 gigabytes of RAM, we'll leave workload unlimited, it will be great. It's really not. First, because our working set is way larger than 4 gigs, so if you do that, the machine immediately dies. Also, because it turns out it's not quite easy to tell what the workload is. In a lot of cases, say your workload is the web server, but the web server gets configuration data from another daemon. If that daemon is in system and gets kept and becomes really slow, the web server is very angry. So you need to figure something out there. The way we're addressing that is by making a sub-bucket under workload and moving some of these daemons there so we can control them better. The other thing we're doing is shifting the focus from doing memory limits and hard limiting in general to doing protection. So doing things like systemd as like memory low or memory.low in C group parlance that give you protection, like guarantee that this service will have at least this amount of memory available rather than hard limit this other service. And this isn't always the solution. And all of this stuff is hard. Like it requires you to understand in fair detail how your service works, what the dependencies are, how memory management in the kernel works, and how these apply together with C groups. So there's a lot of work to do to make this more simple and easier. And we hope to be able to get to the point where we can give people a tool that they can run and can give them an idea of, OK, these are sane defaults for your service based on what we see. Start with that and try. So another thing we are interested in doing is service monitoring. And that stems from the fact that, as I said before, we had like 5 or 6 ways to do service monitoring, service management for bare metal, but they were all like fairly blind. Like we didn't have a good way to pull metrics from services. But systemd does. Because systemd knows a lot of things about you because it's supervising you directly. It stores them, and crucially, it exposes them over dbus. So you get properties like all the timestamp properties. When did I start? How long have I been running? When was I restarted the last time? 235 added a thing that's really awesome, that's n restarts. That's by far the main thing that people ask me that they would like to know. Like, is my service flapping? People are really interested in that, because if your service is flapping, it's very likely that something is wrong. So these kind of things are useful, and they're easy to get out of systemd through dbus. Systemd also gives you status events where you can hook to the service on the bus, and you can hook to systemd on the bus, and it will send you a notification whenever the service changes. So it goes from inactive to active, and so on and so forth. So it gives you basically a view of the state machine and what's going on. Now the downside of these is that these are exposed through dbus, so you need to talk to dbus to get them out. And so we started looking at ways to do this. Well. So, by the way, you don't need to talk to dbus. You can use systemctl show, and it will dump them all. The problem of doing that is that you don't want to run systemctl show in a tight loop on every machine, because that's going to take up a lot of resources, and it's fairly brittle. So you'd really want a programmatic way to do this. So if you look online, there's a few toy projects, I'd say, on GitHub that already do this to some extent. And they all of them use either Python dbus or libdbus. Which would be great, except after 2 weeks trying to get that to build in our internal build system, we essentially gave up. And I'm still not quite sure what was going on there. And it's definitely not an issue with dbus itself. It's an issue with like how we do things at Facebook. But long story short, it was not resulting in binaries that would run. So we started looking at alternatives. And obvious alternatives would be using sdbus, which is included in systemd for a while. The downside there is that sdbus is a plain C API, and there are not really any wrappers for it. I really didn't want to write this in C, because then I would have to maintain it. And like most people in infrared Facebook are like Python people and not C people. There's also C people, but they're harder to come by. And also for a prototype, because I don't quite know if this would work. Like writing a prototype in C, not a great idea, at least from my standpoint. So I started looking at things, and I found that the CoreOS folks had also bindings in Go. And these bindings don't rely on libdbus. They're standalone. And they work. So I don't know Go, but I figured I could pick it up. So I did that. And I wrote a POC of this in Go. And this is basically a small daemon that runs on the box. It hooks using the dbus API to systemd. It polls for unit properties and uses subscriptions to get events. And then it collects this data internally, messages it a bit, and then shoots it out to a few of our monitoring systems, so we can get like pretty pictures and data and things like that. And that was fine for a POC. I was a bit uneasy of doing this in like a language I didn't know very well, and basically as a hack. But then Alvaro came along, and Alvaro works on Instagram, and they have the same problem, because they use systemd to manage their services. So he started looking at this, and Alvaro is a better coder than I am, and he know he knows how to use Cython. So he wrote a wrapper using Cython on top of SDBus. If you don't know about Cython, it's this magical Python thing that lets you call a C API from Python and expose what you get back in terms of Python objects. So using this system, we can talk to systemd through dbus and talk to it, and we get to interact with real Python objects that translate that internally to dbus calls, which is kind of neat, especially for prototyping, because you get a nice REPL where you can like directly poke at things and get properties and see how it behaves and see if it makes sense. So we're likely going to use this and rewrite my prototype on this. We're going to open source this. I actually have the repo mostly ready, so it should be out in a couple of weeks. And SystemIMON itself, we have to figure out how to release it, but we expect to release it at some point, ideally this year. So hopefully people will find this useful, and I would love to get feedback on whether something like this could be useful, or if you have ideas of like how you deal with this problem, or ways we could do this better. All right, now let's move on to interesting stories and case studies. So by far the main thing that still causes random issues that we don't quite understand is dbus in production. The problem with dbus is that when the daemon gets sad or angry, systemd also gets sad or angry. And problems with the daemon cannot really be resolved without rebooting the machine, because dbus doesn't really support takeover in place. So most of the time when bad things happen, your only resort is rebooting the machine, which is fine for a laptop, but not fine for a server. The other problem is that if you get the system to a state where systemd is still mostly working, but the connection is severed, so systemctl is not working, either if it's hanging or if our product failing with like connection to bus failed, for us, that manifests a chef failing on the box, because chef cannot manage services anymore, so it will yell at you. Which is a problem, because then people get all the chef failures, but they're not really actionable for them, because they see, oh, what is this dbus stuff? The other thing we found is that it's actually surprisingly easy to DOS dbus and put it in a bad state. We had a coworker who was doing tests with user services, and he wrote a thing that when you would log in on the box, in your bash RC, you would start a user service that would do some stuff and then start other things. That semi-reliably managed to crash it, not on every machine, on like a good chunk of machines. Unfortunately, a lot of these problems are hard to pin down. And like, I would love to be able to get like, okay, here's a repro and file a bug upstream, but I don't have that. I have on X percent of machines, sometimes this happens and it's really fucking hard to find it. So right now we're mitigating this by basically rebooting machines when necessary and trying to keep dbus up to date and get bug fixes. We're also looking at alternatives. There's this dbus broker project that's an initial replacement of the dbus daemon coming after the bus one project that we started looking at and testing on a small number of machines. And it looks promising, but I don't have any hard data on whether it works well at our scale. But I'm definitely interested to see how this fares and if it's going to behave in a more reliable way or in an easier way to remediate in case of issues. Let's move on. RPM macros, yes. So this is one that's more like people problem than technological problems. So a lot of the stuff we build at Facebook they're not like large, complicated tools. They're like one binary. You have to ship one binary, one systemd unit, and that's it. So we have a tool that you feed it your build config, and it spits out an RPM. It makes your spec file. Makes you a system, it takes your system service, adds the right macros, and here's your RPM, which is fine. The macros that you get by default, by Fedora, restart your service on package update, which is also fine. Except a lot of people are used to the old design pattern from Zen 5, from Zen 6, when you do in Chef, you do package upgrade and then notify your service and ask Chef to restart it. If you're doing that and you're also restarting on upgrade, you're restarting twice, which doesn't seem to be a bad thing, except maybe your service takes quite a while to start or takes up a lot of resources when it's starting or starts talking to the world. So this fix for this was really easy. Like you add a knob in the tool so you can disable the default restart behavior and you're done. The trick was like socializing this and understanding that this was actually the problem and figuring out how to propagate it. And there's a few things like this that I'll have later that are not necessarily technical issues, but more like getting things to be better understood. Another area of interest for us is the journal and logging. So the journal for us is set up to only log in memory, log in a small in-memory buffer, and then feed everything to syslog. And we do this because we have a ton of infrastructure based on syslog, around security. So we need syslog to keep going. And people are used to syslog. People want to be able to do tell the chef varlog messages and see their stuff. On the other hand, we found pretty quickly that when people actually start understanding what the journal is and start playing with it, they really like it. People start using journal CTL and like, oh, I can filter by things. This actually works. So people started asking us, okay, can I use the journal? Because I'd like to get more data than just that the shitty 10 megabyte buffer. You can, of course. You can enlarge the buffer. You can make it store on disk. When you do that, though, you end up with a double writing problem because you're writing both to our syslog and to the journal. They both write to disk. And some of our tools are really chatty. So you can end up writing like megabytes or more per second, which is not ideal if you're I/O constrained. And it's also an all or nothing proposition, because you either do this system-wide or you don't do it at all. So what we'd really like to get is some way to do this on a per unit basis. So people could say, for this application, I want the journal data to have these buffers and go on disk and be persistent, for this to be transient. But we haven't found a good way to do that. So for now, what we're telling our customers to do is either take the hit of the double writing or set things in such a way that they silence some of the stuff that ends up ending up in syslog, but that causes other problems. So it's not really a tenable solution in the long run. Now, another fun, for some value of fun, problem we had was loops. So I didn't know this. I discovered this by when I hit this problem. But if there's a loop, systemd breaks the loop between a dependency loop between units, it will break it by removing an arbitrary unit from the loop. And it tells you, it puts a log line like that. And we found this out because we boot machine and they would come up and they would be missing temp files and directories that were supposed to be created by systemd temp files. And then chef would fail because this directory that's supposed to be here is not here. And I was like, what the hell? So you look at the logs and you see that line, which is, okay, that's interesting. Why? The way we debug this was using systemd analyze. And systemd analyze gives you both boot chart style plots, like time zero, the system boots, time one, systemd starts, time two, the service starts. And it gives you dependency graphs. So nice, like octopus style graphs with dependencies. That's completely useless for us, because if you plot it, you end up like the size of this room in graph paper to get it out. But you can make it plot a small subset. And that part is useful. Because in this case, that line gave us enough clue to know that like SMC proxy, which is a thing we ran, was responsible somehow. So we started using analyze from there, discovered that it has something to do with mount, found that somebody added to fstab an entry to ask to mount this network file system and make it require SMC proxy, which is fine, but they didn't say it was actually a network file system. So this ended up ordered in an ordering conflict, because it's like you need the file system, which needs the service, which needs the network, but the network needs this, and this doesn't work. So fixing this is adding netdev to the fstab entry, and we're done. But the process of finding it was a bit more interesting than that, and that's one thing that we also like. I wasn't personally aware this was a thing, so it took a while to dig through the logs and see that this line was a problem, and this is what was going on here. On a somewhat similar vein, another fun problem that we had was around transient units and systemd run. So we have these machines that do builds and testing for like mobile apps, and the way they do that is that there's a lot of phones plugged in USB essentially, and then we run stuff that does things on the phone. And the way the team that manages does it, they use systemd run to start these processes. And they run this using a device allow policy, so they only talk to the thing they're supposed to talk. And they run this a lot, because we do a lot of tests, we have a lot of phones. And every time this runs, it enqueues a unit, runs a unit, does its thing, disposes of the unit, all good. But like USB cables aren't great, sometimes stuff breaks, so this can also fail. When unit fails, systemd lets them stick around, they stick around in like failed, and they're there. Not a problem if it's like 1, 2, 3, 5. Wait a bit. If you end up with like 10,000 units, there's something in in PID1 that reads this and ends up taking a shit ton of CPU. Like we saw with 10K failed units, this goes around 50% CPU usage on the box. With 30K, it goes around 100%. And that's when people started noticing, because it was kind of interesting. So the fix is putting a cron job that caused reset failed. Yes. Yes, that's also what I told people to try. But like for now, what the way this was fixed was because people wanted to get a sense of how bad the problem was. So what they did was they added a monitoring counter that would tell them how many failed units are there, and then they added a remediation. If it's past the threshold, call reset failed. But yeah, ignoring the result is likely the better option. I need to check if there's a way to do that with systemd-run directly, or if they need to write a unit.
I just thought about that we maybe want to improve systemd-run so that systemd-run can still extract the failed stuff, but then systemd-run automatically make sure that the thing goes away anyway.
Oh, yeah, that would be awesome. I think that would take care of the case here. Yeah, because in these cases, failures that are not really actionable, because if it's failed, it's not because of something we can control. On to more fun, this time cGroup related. If you have a service systemd by default, when you terminate it, it kills everything in the cGroup. You can change this. You can tell it, don't kill everything in the cGroup, only kill the main process and leave everything else to fend off by itself. Which we try to discourage people from doing, but people are stubborn and sometimes do their own thing. If you combine this, and when that happens, if you end up with leftover processes, the cGroup stays around because there are services in the cGroup, of course. There's processes in the cGroup. So what happens if you then reload? You change the configuration of that service that before was in this slice, you make it go to this other slice, and then reload systemd. And ideally, you'd expect it would apply the change. Turns out it doesn't if there's already a cGroup running with these processes in, which makes sense. And fixing this is easy. You kill everything, or you change it to the control group. But this was kind of surprising, and it caused a bit of consternation for people because they really wanted to use kill mode process for reasons not particularly interesting here. And the fact that the old unit was sticking around wasn't quite as evident. And you basically find out because you run systemctl status, and it shows as stopped, but it also shows the cGroup is still there. And then you poke in sysfs cGroup, and you see it is there, and there's processes running. And then the only resort is just kill everything. Yes. Yes. In this case, yes. The question was, is there a reason if we're not using kill mode mix? In this case, the reason was that the thing we were starting was not actually the process. It was a thing that would spawn off a bunch of children and do like hand-wavy supervision of these children, and they wanted that they could replace the supervisor but not the children. It was something like that. So like the solution was redesigned is to not do that, because you shouldn't do supervision in your application. But yeah, I don't know if we tried mix specifically, but I remember the folks that had this system were fairly adamant. They wanted to use kill mode process the way that it designed. But for the specific thing, there's not much we can do, because like the current behavior actually makes sense, so it's not a problem. It's just something that's not evident at all. Finally, for like most stupid and yet irritating bug I found, the escape systemd has this logic that translates device names and paths to unit names, and it uses shell control characters. So /dev/something becomes /dev-something, and then escape. Now /escape is also a shell control character. So if you take that and then write, I don't know, systemctl status something and shell out to that without escaping it, you're gonna have a bad time. So Chef did that, which made it interesting when we were trying to write a cookbook to manage swap devices in some special way, and it would like fail because of a weird shell escape stuff. So we fixed it. The fix was like really trivial, and it was basically make sure we call shell escape. This was something that was somewhat embarrassing, because it took a while to figure out that was the actual thing that was going on, and we're like, we should have caught this before. As part of this, we have a cookbook that to manage systemd that's open source. We open source all of our cookbooks. They're on GitHub. So we had a small wrapper to wrap the systemd escape function to get a unit name from path, so you don't have to shell out from it. So this closes the gallery of horrors. So I want to spend a few minutes to talk about like how you do these things and try to not make people too angry. Because of course, if you look at things from the point of view of the service owner, the application owner, you kind of like your system to be stable and sort of static. On the other hand, you want to get new features, and you want to know that your system is stable, but is also getting updates. So the approach we found that works reasonably well for us is trying to communicate things as much as possible to people and make sure people understand why you're doing this. So announcing core package updates widely and announcing changes that are happening and why they're happening and what's going on with them and giving people a venue to comment on whether, oh, this feature is interesting, I'd like to know more, I'd like to use it, or, oh, this is going to cause me trouble. And doing these updates in such a way that people can react to them and give you early feedback. When we did one of the system version upgrades, it happened to actually cause issues to the same folks that did the phone stuff, because they were doing other C group things, and it was fine. We could like just pin them to the old version for now, resolve it, and then move on. The other thing we found is the documentation is critical. And while upstream documentation is great and very detailed, it is not great if you don't know what you're doing and you're starting from the place of wanting to learn. So we started writing like internally, like snippets of like, okay, this is the suggested way to do things, to do like a basic unit, to do this or that. And we found that doing this with the customer use case in mind works better. We also encourage people to like follow what's going on with upstream, because we don't have all the answers. So people can read the source code, because this is an open source project. They can go on the mailing list, they can look at things. And finally, we found that talking and giving tech talks internally, both as a company and both going to a team and sit at a team meeting and talk to them for half an hour about what they're doing, what is the system they think, what you can do with it, goes a long way making people happier and more amenable to using this and leveraging it and then actually liking it and building cool things with it. And with this, thank you very much. And I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Minor clarification. He said all of our cookbooks are open source. They are not, and our lawyers will get angry.
Yes.
Some of our cookbooks are open source.
Some of our core cookbooks. Yes. Thank you, Phil.
Okay. So I was curious, you were mentioning one of the things that you're having issues with in terms of Chef integrating with systemd is with system control and things hanging. Is that because of daemon reloads or something else with the kind of lockup, aside from dbus issues?
So Chef shells out to systemctl for basically every interaction it does with systemd. So if I have a unit that say, I want this service to be started, I want this service to be enabled, I'm adding a new unit or I'm changing a unit and I need to reload systemd. All of these things end up calling systemctl. So each and any of these interactions, if the system is unhealthy and systemctl either returns an error or hangs, will lead to Chef failing.
What I'm curious is if you know what the root cause is on the systemd, say PID1 side, of why those things are hanging for you.
We know it sometimes. Like the kernel TTY race is one example where we found out what it was. In other cases, we don't. And for some, we pin it down to dbus. Most of the ones that are like unknown, they're like we're fairly sure it's something with the dbus comms, but we haven't managed to repro it in a way that we can actually poke at it more and get some actual data out of it. Yes.
Regarding the issues with RPM database and inconsistent packages, have you looked into deploying using Atomic or OS3 or similar stuff?
No. And I'll tell you why. The main thing is that for system packages specifically, we want to try to stay as close as possible to how upstream is built and how upstream works, because it makes it a lot easier to keep things not too alien, so people can understand it. And when you interact with people outside, we might well, look at that in the future. But I think in the short midterm, I think we're gonna stick with RPM and just deal with the things. The other thing we're doing is actually trying to make RPM better, and we're actually engaging with the RPM developers and the YAML developers there. So hopefully we'll have something there soon. Well, my time is up. Thank you very much, folks.